From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Hope you're having a fantastic week. It's only going to get better, I am sure. And keep it here, 1-866-408-7669. We'll be following all the events. We know Kamala Harris has got a big meeting today. We'll discuss some of that. And we'll continue to update you on what's happening in the world. Kayleigh McEnany is going to be joining us at the bottom of the hour. That'll be great. And also, we are going to be, you can also write me, BrianKilmeade.com, and get the podcast at BrianKilmeade.com. You just sign up wherever you get your podcast. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
If it gets to be much smarter than us, it'll be very good at manipulation because it will have learned that from us. And it knows how to program, so it'll figure out ways of getting around restrictions we put on it. It'll figure out ways of manipulating people to do what it wants.
Jeffrey Hinton talking. He's one of the founders and godfathers of AI, talking about the rise of it. Front and center for the Biden administration, Kamala Harris is tasked with leading a push with all the AI inventors and some other staffers on setting up guardrails for artificial intelligence. Does anyone feel optimistic that she can handle this latest task? Me neither.
Number two.
New York and Chicago, they are self-declared sanctuary cities. So you would think they would be asking for me to be busing migrants to their cities. This is not a Texas problem. This is a United States problem.
Greg Abbott weighing in, now talking about race, talking about illegal immigrants, help needed and none is coming. That's the state of the ongoing calamity at our border. Cities are overwhelmed with illegal aliens. Border communities are crushed, private border farms trampled, and there are cries of racism from one mayor to a governor of Texas. We have it all.
Number one.
We have credible information that this possible criminal activity took place. And I can't verify whether or not it's really a criminal activity, but I do have faith in the whistleblowers.
That is Chuck Grassley. Listen up. Long rumored, often accused. Now, could there be proof of Joe Biden's family operation to change our foreign policy to fill Biden's pockets? Whistleblower comes forward. The FBI is subpoenaed for documents. Separately, Hunter Biden seems as though he's going to be charged for tax and or gun issues that have been plaguing the president's son for 4 years. So this is the news that came across yesterday. Everyone always says, now, Biden's out there trading on the family name. What's the actual business? What are they trading on? If Trump goes and wants to open up a business in Scotland, golf course. Saudi Arabia, hotel. Turkey, hotel. New York City, towers. Commercial real estate. So they have something to sell. You might not like it. Affects foreign policy. I don't feel good. Whatever you want. But for the Bidens, it's selling influence. But they go, what influence? Because he's no longer vice president. In between jobs, president, what influence did he have? Well, he's got a ton of influence. He's known these same people for 40 years making the laws. But nothing drew directly back to him in a way that everyone had to pay attention. Tony Bobulinski saying he was getting a certain percentage of deals that he was in on. We got it, but didn't seem to get traction. But now you have a whistleblower coming forward, some say a stunning development, to the House Oversight Committee. They issued a subpoena on Wednesday for an FBI file that a whistleblower said links President Biden to a criminal scheme involving money for policy decisions. Man, that would be unprecedentedly evil. The tip is a potential breakthrough for investigators looking into Joe Biden's increasing role in the family enterprise, in the businesses. Now, the New York Post speculates on businesses that we know about, thanks to the laptop. Could he have a link? Could this whistleblower have a link to Mexico, where we know the president had breakfast with Carlos Slim and one of the associates of Hunter Biden, Jeff Cooper? Carlos Slim, one of the richest men in the world, from Mexico and Russia. The Moscow mayor has a relationship with Devin Archer as well as Hunter Biden. They met at Lake Cuomo over in April. Could they have done a deal back in 2014? Could this be something that was reignited? Romania, a Romanian businessman, Gabriel Popoviciu, in early 2015, they helped him. Hunter Biden was his lawyer, helped him challenge a corruption conviction. What do they want in return? Well, it turns out on the calendar, Hunter Biden, second son, you'll have breakfast with my dad before you return, November 15, 2016. Did that the deal that Hunter's doing? What about China? Know about him flying with Air Force Two. You know about the CEFC energy company linked directly to the government. Now, Ian Sams, the White House spokesperson for oversight and investigation, says for 5 years, Republicans in Congress have been lobbying unfounded, unproven, politically motivated attacks against the president and his family without offering evidence for their claims. Well, that thing could have changed. Here's more from Grassley. Cut two.
What kind of criminal scheme did Joe Biden supposedly participate in?
All I can answer to you is that that from the credible whistleblower, we get this information. The document exists, and we'll have to get the document to be able to answer your question.
We haven't gotten it yet. Now, will the FBI give it? They have to give it, right? Subpoena. What's the big deal? If it's corruption with the president of the United States, got to give it up. What do you mean you're going to hold on to it? Now, if this was the previous president, it would have been leaked already by the FBI itself. According to a source within the FBI, there's a document out there that proves that the Trump family was linked to some type of international scheme that affects policy. Believe me, we would have heard it. Now, I keep telling you about the double standard. You hear about it. But when it's so egregious, I just want to point it out. Here's more from Grassley. Cut three.
Do you believe that the subpoena will also ultimately be successful and Chairman Comer will be able to obtain this document? What level of confidence do you have?
It'll be successful unless the White House classifies this document. And they better not, because I know it's a non-classified document. But they could keep me from getting it by classifying it.
How evil would that be? You classify it rather than give it up after it's requested? Is that allowed? Brett Tolman, longtime U.S. attorney, was speculating last night on what this could mean and what could be next. Cut nine.
A document like this really comes down to one thing in my mind, and this is probably an FBI 302 investigative report. I say that because the whistleblower, in order to make the connection and to assess that it's credible information like Senator Grassley has assessed, means that they had to have sat down with whoever's providing the information, and you're not going to do that without making sure you get every detail you can from someone.
So we'll see. We'll get the analysis. I'll be talking about that with Kayleigh McEnany. We'll see how this moves forward. I don't want a witch hunt. I would not be prescribing this a witch hunt. Remember, the Whitewater thing became such a distraction. They stumble onto the Monica Lewinsky thing. Believe it or not, as embarrassing as it was for Bill Clinton, it changed his fortunes for the positive. And I think if it looks like you're just going down the pike to try to find something on an 80-year-old president, then that's a problem. But if you could talk about how it affects policy, already James Comer outlined six different decisions that could have been influenced by investments that have turned up in the Biden family. So let's talk about the border crisis. Title 42 is going to evaporate in 7 days. We are seeing a big surge at the border already. Now, I know what you're thinking. I know El Salvador, Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, now Brazil. Well, it turns out it's getting more complicated. We're getting people from India, China, Brazil, Turkey. I know it's a terrible government, but isn't there a way to apply for citizenship instead of sneaking in? Uzbekistan, Senegal, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Egypt. In Afghanistan, if you can get out, you probably came through the border. And then you pay somebody to get you up to the border, and then you hope to be able to cross the border. And right now we have a situation they can't possibly address this adequately. Now we have a mayor in New York City in particular that says it's racist that the white Republican governor of Texas keeps sending people to black cities. No, they're asking to go to cities because they know they're in the border cities in Texas. You're kind of in the middle of nowhere. So they want something different. So here is Jonathan Fahey. He is the DHS Deputy Assistant Secretary under Trump. Cut 17.
Everything this administration says is either an outright lie, deliberately misleading, or utter nonsense. And, you know, and what the press secretary says is typically just utter nonsense on this. Of course it's not down. It's we're going to be looking at hundreds of thousands of people per month coming across with no plan to deal with them, no plan to deal with the expenses. And you see what's going on in New York right now. This is not just a border problem. This is a resource problem for every community where the illegal immigrants land. And there is no plan to deal with it. And I don't see anything changing, at least in the next 2 years.
All right, we're going to take a short time out because the numbers are pretty staggering. Listen to this. Over the last 10 days, 7,700 arrests per day. 7,700. Title 42 ends 7 days. 700% increase over normal days during the Obama and Trump administration. We've just begun to accept it. I don't. We have lying propagandists running this country in the DHS right now. That, according to Border Patrol Union President. They say don't believe one word this administration's saying. How can you possibly influence a union that has that little respect for you? I ask you, Mayorkas. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We'll talk about AI, too, stuff we don't know. And then we'll have Kayleigh McEnany at the bottom of the hour. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You've spoken out saying that AI could manipulate or possibly figure out a way to kill humans? How could it kill humans?
Well, eventually, if it gets to be much smarter than us, it'll be very good at manipulation because it will have learned that from us. There are very few examples of a more intelligent thing being controlled by a less intelligent thing. And it knows how to program, so it'll figure out ways of getting around restrictions we put on it. It'll figure out ways of manipulating people to do what it wants.
Pretty amazing. That's Jeffrey Hinton. They call him the father of AI. Why? He had this small company that had such promising advances, AI. Google bought it. And then with it, they were able to launch Chatbot, GPT, and now there's Bard and others are out there. And there's big talk about from Elon Musk on down, who helped found the whole thing, saying this could get out of control. We need regulation. About, I think, 40 people signed off on it, another 19 want to get together and start collaborating on it. I worry that if we limit ourselves, that China will get the lead. They do not have our best interests in mind. Here's more from Jeffrey Hinton, cut 19.
It's not clear to me that we can solve this problem. I believe we should put a big effort into thinking about ways to solve the problem. I don't have a solution at present. I just want people to be aware that this is a really serious problem, and we need to be thinking about it very hard. I don't think we can stop the progress. I didn't sign the petition saying we should stop working on AI, because if people in America stopped, people in China wouldn't. It's very hard to verify whether people are doing it.
Very interesting. So he's out there fighting it. He said, if I step away, people look at me more sincerely as somebody who's really concerned. That's why he doesn't want to stop it. I never heard of stopping progress. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, but I understand the feeling of wanting to, you know, stop the Industrial Revolution. No, stop the advent of cars if you sell horses. You know, the people were reluctant to get the internet. They thought it would hurt libraries. When it comes to books, they said, we don't want to do the e-books. It's going to destroy the book industry. It didn't happen with any of that. I was just struck by, if it was just me, I would never say stop anything. But when Elon Musk and all those others said, I'm telling you, they could be more powerful than us. And Jeffrey Hinton said, I thought in 50 years they'd have the ability to be more power than us, AI. But now he says it's just days away. So that's pretty key. Other things that might affect it, for example, believe it or not, the internet could be destroyed by AI. Look at what Neil deGrasse Tyson said. Cut 20.
Part of me wonders, maybe AI will create such good fakes that no one will trust the internet anymore for anything. And we just have to simply shut it down. Maybe it's the final nail of a coffin in the internet. 30 years, it was a good run from the early 90s to the early 20s and 2020s. Now it's time for the next thing. That could be the greatest gift of AI to the internet. The internet gets a vote of no confidence from us.
I know he's an astrophysicist, but I think that's one of the weird things to bring up. There's always going to be a Google search engine. If it gets outdated, it gets outdated. But people are going to not trust anything that goes there. And I think that maybe there'll be a way to say this is AI generated. This isn't. You might want to say maybe there's going to be rules, for example, that you'll say that this program was generated by AI. The comedy writers were AI. You have to say that up front. Maybe that should be a rule. Senator James Langford was making the rounds with Senator Sinema on this. Cut 23.
All the American public are talking about artificial intelligence. This has been an issue for a long time. I'm glad the administration is finally engaging on this. It needs to be addressed. And it's not just an administrative policy, but it's learning what's the benefits, what are the harms, and try to get ahead of it. We've all seen what's happened in multiple areas where you allow technology to get ahead of what the regulatory state really is on it to be able to make sure that we're managing a good thing and making sure it stays for good. It's not used for evil.
Right. Let's do that. So talk about not used for good and used by the right people for the right reasons. Kamala Harris, again, they're trying to prop her up and say she's been mislabeled for 2.5 years. You don't know the real Kamala Harris. Well, today she's going to be leading discussion in a meeting with Google, Microsoft, OpenAI, and Anthropic CEOs. What are they going to be talking about? All this. And what does regulation look like? Gina Raimondo, maybe the most smartest person in the administration, will be there. Jeff Zients, his new chief of staff. Jake Sullivan will be there. Arati Palmarkar, the director of Office and Science and Technology, will be there. And we'll see if we can get guardrails up that defy logic to think the government could keep up with this and regulate this. But if you use the experts and they could do it themselves, I think that would be fine. But just understand, too, if we do anything that allows us to fall behind China, they'll export that technology, again, considering with their Belt and Road initiatives. Barack Obama was lecturing about the disinformation. You wonder where he is. He was out there lecturing, talking about it. He doesn't really get specifically into it, but I thought you should get his perspective. He put this on Twitter, Cut 24.
We're at an inflection point with rising inequality, deepening polarization, and widespread disinformation. I plan to keep shining a light on the biggest challenges that democracy faces. That includes revitalizing our political institutions, coming up with more inclusive and sustainable models of capitalism, and creating a stronger democratic culture. But it also means creating an information environment that reinforces rather than erodes our democracy.
All right, so he's talking generically. He's not talking like he knows AI. I want to talk a little about the Ukraine war. It looks like a total false flag operation with a drone being struck down at the Kremlin. It was not the Ukrainians. I know last week I read a report like that. The Ukrainians say, no, we basically, they're saying, I don't have a drone that can get there. So if you see the video, it's got every angle on it. And we know that Moscow's buried in debt. So maybe they want to start motivating their people to think that if we don't act, Kyiv is going to attack us in Moscow. We won't be safe now. Meanwhile, they've lost 85,000 people in battle, 200,000 casualties, and now they're about to try to absorb a big surge. Here is John Kirby talking about the U.S. involvement in this and what Russia is propagating. Cut 26.
I can assure you that there was no involvement by the United States in this, whatever it was, and we had nothing to do with this. So Peskov is just lying there, pure and simple.
Right. We'll see. I don't think Kyiv could get to Russia. And wouldn't you think Russia's got missile defense everywhere? So I am surprised by that. And John Kirby weighing in. They were caught by surprise by it. But I do think things have blown up in Crimea, and I do think that is the Ukrainians. They want to start loosening up these targets, taking back substantial landmass. And that's it. And if you want to factor in China in after that to get a peace deal, that's more plausible possible. Haley McEnany's next. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I would hesitate to take everything that the Hill says at face value. There has been a clear track record of, in many instances, of transcripts being intentionally taken out of context, being intentionally misrepresented. And so we don't know what exactly the intent or what's going on here. But as I said, we've seen the inquiry and we will review it appropriately.
So that's Vedant Patel of the State Department. He's a State Department spokesperson responding to, I believe, the request for, which is going to be a subpoena eventually, I think, for the Secretary of State to come in and try to and try to explain himself when he said there was no interaction between Hunter Biden and the Secretary Blinken when he was deputy secretary. He said, oh, there was no interaction. That's how it was part of his confirmation, according to Ron Johnson. Obviously, the emails revealed there was a lot of interaction. In fact, I would leap to the fact that I believe that he gets along better with Hunter than he does Joe. Kelly McEnany here, co-host of Outnumbered, gets set to do that show. A book is now out, Serenity in the Storm, Living Through the Chaos by Leaning on Christ. Kaylee, welcome. Your response to some of the inaccuracies, clearly, you saw the emails. It's not even up for conjecture or debate.
It's not. And one of the things that I was so struck by was you have Blinken who says, you know, Mike Morrell's testimony confirms everything I'm saying. And that was with regard to, him not being a part of the 51 foreign intel folks who said that this was Russian disinformation, the laptop. But Mike Morrell's testimony said he was integral to it. So the testimony completely contradicts Blinken. And then with regard to the emails, you're exactly right. There's emails from Hunter Biden to the wife of Blinken saying, hey, what's Blinken's private email? And then there were multiple email correspondences. That's what we know of. So there is more here. And this cannot be written off as just nothing to see here because there are facts, hard facts that contradict the platitudes coming from the State Department.
And what you're referring to is Benjamin Hall asked the question, Anthony Blinken, about Mike Morrell saying that you were the one behind who helped round up the 51 intel experts that called the laptop Russian disinformation. He goes, no, that's not what his testimony is.
Right.
So you got to turn around and go, yes, it is. And then Mike Morrell, I've not seen him. He doesn't have a CBS contract anymore. But Mike Morrell was all over the Libya situation. He was the disinformation there about the attacks. So he has respect in the Bush world. Mm-hmm. He used to brief George W. Bush in the times of most perilous times after the 9/11 attacks. And then he stayed and briefed Obama. So he's been on our show a lot. Like, I like having him on, but it is a complex situation that he's weaving. And when asked about it, he said, well, I wanted to see Joe Biden win. Really? You put your reputation on the line to make sure Joe Biden, and by the way, he didn't get a job out of it.
Right. All 51 of these guys. I mean, they were essentially Biden surrogates. And you expect that among maybe media personalities or political appointees who've worked in the West Wing who are political in nature. But you don't expect that, to your point, among credible intel officials who have respect across both sides of the aisle. So it's really astonishing when you look back. And all 51, to your point, signed up despite the reputational damage that would come, the facts that would come out later. They just signed their name to support a Joe Biden presidency.
Instead of really looking into it, and you would think CIA guys like Leon Panetta is 70-something years old, all you have to do is pick up the phone and say, hey, Joe, is this your son's laptop? Because I'm about to sign off on this. I'll just stay out of it.
Right.
But don't let me ruin my reputation. I was chief of staff, CIA director, secretary of defense. I mean, come on. I want you to win, but I can't do that. Like Dan Hoffman said, why would I sign this? I don't know anything about it.
Exactly.
Walked away from it.
Exactly. And this laptop, I mean, it has hundreds and hundreds of pictures of Hunter Biden, emails between Hunter Biden and his father, among others. So that wouldn't cause, it would cause just a common sense individual like myself to pause and say, hey, this is likely Hunter Biden's laptop. Like, what did they all believe? That this was a Russia AI generated deepfake that was full of pictures of Hunter Biden? I mean, it defies reality to think that they just signed on and truly believe this was disinformation.
So when the girl has his kid, when the woman who used to be a stripper has his kid, she's now 4. Her name is Navy Joan. He goes, I don't really remember. I don't remember if. And then it, when asked about, is that your laptop on a book tour? He has a book tour. Knowing that, he goes, I don't really remember. It's my laptop. Don't remember. Who? He's almost taunting us.
Yeah.
He's taunting us with, you can't touch me. So why are you even trying?
Who doesn't remember conceiving a child? I mean, this is really something.
And then, he gets away with this.
And he's forced to take a paternity test. And it turns out that, yes.
It's his kid.
Yes, it is his child, that poor 4-year-old girl. But that case, I mean, really interesting. There's been so many redactions of Hunter Biden's financial records. And if this judge can force transparency and wipe away some of the redactions, who knows the connection that it may have to the broader interest in Hunter Biden's business dealings?
Kaylee McEnany, our guest. Kaylee, did you have this story about the whistleblower coming forward about possibly the president using business, having his businesses affect policy? Was that on for Outnumbered? Was that out?
Yes. It was not on for Outnumbered yesterday. We are doing it today. It broke, I think, later in the day, and the New York Post had some additional details. But it's something, you know, I pause here because the allegation is so stunning that there's this document that outlines a direct connection between Joe Biden delivering a policy decision in exchange for cash. I don't know why it would be outlined in a public document. The document, the FD, I forget the numbers at the end, but it's an FBI document that when you receive confidential information, it's a way to memorialize that information in an official form. So, you know, it's easy to be hyped up about it now, but until I see the document, you know, I'm kind of hesitant. I hope it's not being overblown.
Right. But the one thing that gives you credibility is Senator Grassley. I want people to hear. I mean, here he is. Cut one.
We have credible information that this possible criminal activity took place, and I can't verify whether or not it's really a criminal activity, but I do have a faith in the whistleblowers that bring it to me that this document exists. We have a rough idea of what's in the document, and I just want to do what congressional oversight responsibilities I have to see what the FBI's and the DOJ's done to follow up on it.
See, I don't know why people are doubting that the FBI will give up this document because the FBI has to, I thought. But they say they're not going to.
Right. And Grassley said his biggest fear is that an otherwise unclassified document might all of a sudden become classified. Look, I've said this before.
Doesn't that say a lot?
Yeah.
If all of a sudden you classify a document, what are you keeping from me?
It says a lot. I mean, when people talk about the deep state, it's easy to think that this is like something that is, you know, a dark conspiracy theory in the corners of the internet. But we began this segment talking about the 51 intel officials who hook, line, and sinker bought into a fake narrative and essentially swung an election. That's the deep state at work. So these same intel guys, the top echelons of the FBI, I don't know their political viewpoints. I know they've made really bad decisions before that always seem to go in one direction. So I'm not confident we'll see the light of day with this document. But Grassley's confident in this whistleblower. And I would just note an extra layer of credibility here. This whistleblower is distinct from the IRS whistleblower who's alleging that there has been certain favoritism in the Biden investigations.
So, Kaylee, you have a new book out. It's called Serenity in the Storm, fresh off your bestseller. So you must have been writing this through your pregnancy and through the birth, your second child.
That's right. It was really special. I was pregnant the entire time I wrote this book. The Dobbs decision came down. It was an incredible journey through my pregnancy, living the life issue quite literally, and then watching the monumental change at the court. So I wrote about all of these cultural issues and issues like Afghanistan and Ukraine. And the broader theme is there's chaos in our country and our world. And I think faith can bring us above the real divisions that we have and some of the problems.
Why do you think so?
I think when you look at the fact that 1 in 3 young girls are considering suicide, according to the CDC, the ills on social media, the violence in our schools, it's all an outgrowth of a generation and an American people that have decided to leave behind faith in God, patriotism, tradition, all values that made our country great. And when you set those aside, it's no wonder there's this real misery, almost depression, setting in among a younger generation because they look to self rather than the creator of self.
Right. And what happened is if you don't have a main objective, for example, I imagine there would be less depression when you live your life in order to go shoot your own meal, to go find out, get shelter. Your focus is on survival.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have if you're caught in a fire or a flood, your survival. I got to go get a hotel. I got to get clothes. I got to go talk to family. You don't really worry. You have an objective and a goal. I think a lot of people are like, you know, my job's okay, family's all right. I'm still waiting to meet somebody, and they think to themselves, you know, what's the mission? I don't think my country's that special. In fact, I hear it every day. It's not. You know, what is the mission? You know, I don't think I can be the next Elon Musk. So what difference does it really make? There's a lot of people who are rudderless.
And underappreciate the freedoms we have that are embedded in our country. I looked and the fact the church is growing fastest in Afghanistan, Iran, China, Syria, all of these places.
What church is in Iran?
The Christianity.
Really?
Oh, yes. Iran is, I believe, the number one or number two place where Christianity is growing. No. And that's the thing. Apostasy is punishable by death. But I talked to Pastor X. He's a leader in the underground church there. In the last, I believe it's 10 years combined, more converts have been seen than in the last 13 centuries combined. So people see, and I talked to a woman who's whose testimony is amazing, and Taliban-led Afghanistan. We had to talk via Zoom. I had to call her by a different name, and she said people recognize light and darkness. They saw the American soldiers. They associated them with freedom and with faith, and they see the darkness that's come on their country in Iran, in Afghanistan, and they are so receptive to the message of truth.
See, that's the one thing that really hurts more than anything else the way we left Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. People go, well, the country's chaos, they're not used to democracy. Okay, fine. You know what they did? In Kabul, in these different areas, they got the sense of what it was like to put girls in school, to give them a sense of mission, to give a sense of freedom, have a good day and a bad day, and not be afraid they could be arrested when possible. Our presence there gave them a 20-year window to what their life could be.
Yeah.
And we didn't want anything in return. We didn't even take the rare earth, even though it's every Democrat's goal to make everything green. The rare earth is the engine behind this going to make everything green. Look at Iraq. We're in. We left. We just tried to show you what representative government's like. We didn't take anything, even though President Trump wanted to take the oil until we're paid off. And I understand that school of thought. He's like, can we just get a percentage of the oil after all what we've already given the country? But we didn't. We just left. And when we're done, when the dust settles, you could get mad. And then you say, wait a second. They did exactly what they said they were going to do. Mm-hmm. We showed you how we ran your elections. We pulled out. And what it is not, you don't have to copy us. But is it if every human's goal is to be free to find out what you can be in your life, this is the only government that's going to let that happen.
Yet 2,448 service members is what we lost in Afghanistan, and their sacrifice was not in vain. The way we left was dishonorable. It was horrible.
And not worthy of the people that fought there.
Not worthy of the people that fought there. Joe Biden had ample warning from the intel community, ample warning from his generals that this would collapse, and yet he did it anyway because he wanted a photo op on September 11th and a headline saying, out of America's longest war, and it was a tragedy.
How do you feel when he says the Trump administration left me no choice?
False. False. I've talked to several of my former colleagues. They said that there would be a small stay-behind force of special ops guys taking all the equipment out, not pulling the military out before the civilians. There was a plan.
Conditions-based.
Conditions-based withdrawal that was thrown into the trash can by Joe Biden, who wanted a photo op. But the sacrifice of those soldiers, it was not in vain. Because I can tell you, a lot of the people there now recognize the difference between light and darkness. And I do think it's changed many lives in Afghanistan.
For somebody who's always so upbeat and positive, you've had a lot of turmoil. That job as press secretary was unbelievably combative.
It was.
And then when you were at CNN, every time you were on, there was a brawl, right? They did not want to hear what you had to say.
That was almost worse because at least at the podium, I had a microphone that was loud and I could, you know, rise above the noise. But at CNN, you had like 8 microphones of leftists screaming at you and you could get like 5 words in edgewise. So how do you convey a message in 5 words? That was the challenge at CNN.
So now you have a situation where the president of the United States is going to go on CNN for a town hall. And now if this was 2015, it would be interesting.
Yeah.
But from 2015, 2016 to 2021 – they don't let him finish a sentence. They call everything a lie. They set up and make sure that all these so-called town hallers hate him. Do you think this is going to be different for him?
I don't think it will be fair. I don't trust CNN, to your point, stacking town halls, stacking audiences. They have an agenda.
They can't afford to lose him, though.
They can't afford to lose him. And look, the president, you know, good for him for saying, like, look, I want to put my message out there as broadly as I can, reach communities that might not otherwise hear my message. Yes, but I just worry this will be a setup. You know, past is prologue, right? And the past of CNN and their treatment of Republican candidates has not been particularly fair or, you know, just in any way.
In any way. Unless you're a Republican that wants to criticize Trump, you're not going to get any time.
Larry Hogan could get a fair town hall there.
Absolutely. Yeah, so can Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney could do 6 hours.
Yes.
Absolutely. And for you in particular, I've got to find this intramural battle between Republicans fascinating. Do you look for DeSantis to get in and close that gap? What do you think is
going
to happen?
The gap's going to close. I'm confident of that. You know, just anecdotally, going around the country, I've been everywhere. I've been in so many states in the last 2.5 years. There are a lot of people who recognize Florida as the model for freedom. So he's going to get in. I do think the gaps will close. I do think, and I could be wrong here, President Trump does show up at the debate. And I think everything's going to depend on that Fox News debate and the debates thereafter. That's where we'll see real movement in the polls, because it takes big events to really shake up the polls. The Trump indictment certainly did. DeSantis entering the race, I think, will. And then those debate moments. And then it's a state-by-state race.
Right.
You know, national polling is quite literally meaningless. It's Iowa, it's New Hampshire, it's South Carolina, as you know.
And I've always liked Nikki Haley, and there's very few people in the world I respect more than Tim Scott.
Yeah.
And Mike Pence is a quality human being with great experience. So I think it's going to be quality on the stage. I think it's worthy of America. I don't know what's happened on the left because they're refusing to challenge somebody that clearly needs to be challenged.
Yeah. And look, I know Fox News will give a fair debate. I'm certain of that. They did in 2016. I do hope the RNC and Ronna McDaniel are looking very closely at which outlets they will allow subject the candidates to questions, because a CNN debate, their one goal will be mudslinging.
CNBC was not much better.
Nope, not much better.
Kayla, congratulations on the book. It's so important. It's out there. Serenity in the Dream, Living Through the Chaos by Leaning on Christ. Congratulations, Kaylee.
Thank you so much, Brian.
See you outnumbered a few hours.
All right, noon.
Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think it's still possible. I think the case of avoiding a recession is, in my view, more likely than that of having a recession. But it's not that the case of having a recession is, I don't rule that out either. It's possible that we will have what I hope would be a mild recession.
That is Jerome Powell. And Jerome Powell raised rates for the 10th straight time. And it affects all of us. And they say that's the only way to slow the economy, to get us to stop shopping, stop buying houses, stop renting real estate, commercial real estate, stop going on vacation. Because our economy gets too hot. And if our economy is too hot, it's going to make inflation go too high. So it is still at 5-6%. It was at 8%. President wants credit for decreasing it 40%. That's unbelievable to me. Hopefully you're not falling for that. He jacks up inflation intentionally or not. And then when he gets it down half to where it was, he wants credit for getting it down 40%. Nuts. I'm extremely worried about the economy. People keep pointing to the job numbers. You know what I point to? How many in the workforce were actually working? And right now it's at 62 point something percent. We need that around 68, 70%. The people that can work are working to get out there, because there are 10 million open jobs right now. What is the disconnect? Is it a skill situation, or is it a situation where you have so much money because we printed so much and gave so much away, there's no urgency to get out there? I mean, we all grew up in an environment where if you didn't work, you don't have any money. That's what we need to get back to again.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, heard around the world. Thanks so much for everyone tuning in yesterday, especially because we're having this great discussion with Bill Hemmer about AI, and we have some legitimate questions, like all of you have, about what it means and why so many smart people are worried about it. And Kamala Harris, don't worry, is in charge of setting up guardrails for AI, the next generation, because she's done so much so well with what she's been given so far. So she's going to be in charge. Gina Romano will be there, too. And a lot of these CEOs and higher-ups and innovators will be together to find out about AI. And what the thing about waiting about it is, China's not waiting. Russia's not waiting. North Korea's not waiting. Our enemies aren't waiting. So in talking with Bill Hemmer, we had our questions. And then Eric, behind the board, had a great idea. Why don't we give that to Chatbot GPT? And Chatbot wrote a poem about Bill Hemmer and I's questions. And that made a ton of news. Because, Eric, how long until after you pumped in the question till you got the poem?
Oh, seconds. It's quick.
Seconds.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing. And it was great. And then you've got a voice synthesizer.
Yeah. There's a bunch of text-to-speech translators online you can look up. So I just plugged it in there and I spat it back out and I played it.
And people just loved it. It was Yahoo picked it up and it was a big story. Joining us now, the real Mark Thiessen. He doesn't need AI to write his column. We hope. We don't. Hey, listen, he could have. I mean, Mark Thiessen.
Where's my poem?
Right? What did you say?
Where's my poem? I need a poem about me.
Well, you got to do something first. I mean, Hemmer performed for a segment, and then he got a poem in return. You got to do something.
What you could do next time is you could do a voice clone of Hemmer and interview him about AI without even telling him.
That would be
and then
nuts.
Do the interview and then see if your listeners could tell the difference between
Eric. From what you can tell, can I talk Can I talk in real time to this chatbot GPT or Bard or whatever the other one is?
You mean speech?
Yeah, it can't impersonate a person.
No, that one cannot. ChatGPT is only a text generator. It's a language learning machine.
But there are AI now where you can even have video of it. You can have an avatar of a person. And the only thing that gives it away that it's not, that they're not the real person, is they don't have facial expressions really. Oh. They don't blink. They don't like scrupper or their brow or something like that. But you could create an avatar of Hemmer and have him talk and sit in his voice and answer questions for you.
That'll be easier on the staff because they don't like looking at him because he's got a huge
and if you could do that for me, then I don't have to call in once a week.
Right. And this is so problematic for you. This makes your career. So, Mark, let's get to it. Let's talk about this revelation as we know it. And I do want to talk about your column, too, obviously. It's on Ron DeSantis and going for the GOP vote. But the House's subpoena and FBI file on President Biden's possible role in a criminal scheme having policy revolve around his business dealings. Now, we have to ask the FBI to give us this with this whistleblower claims is the smoking gun. And I'm reading that they don't believe the FBI is going to give up this paper. I don't know how the FBI can deny this.
The rumor is what they're going to do is they could classify it is what Grassley says. That's the only way they can avoid it.
But why would they? Why would they?
No, it's exactly right. I mean, what's amazing to me is that so this has supposedly happened when Joe Biden was vice president, right?
Yeah.
And let's state for the record, we don't know if it's true. We don't know if the allegation is real. Serious. We don't know a lot about it, but this supposedly happened when Joe Biden was vice president. How are we? You know, that was almost a decade ago. How are we just learning about this right now? How has this not come out? You know, I mean, if there was something like this about Trump, you don't think that this would have been all over the news? This would have been leaked like ages ago. And the other thing is, this is a whistleblower coming to Grassley. So Grassley is famous for his support. First of all, the reason to take it seriously is because Grassley is taking it seriously because he is not partisan. He is not, you know, he is a well-known champion of whistleblowers. And people tend to come to Chuck Grassley when they've tried internally to do the right thing and can't get the organization to move and they've got no choice but to go to Congress. And then they go to Congress and they go to the one guy who protects whistleblowers, which is Chuck Grassley. So the fact that it's coming from Grassley, one, is makes it credible. Two, it shows how serious it is. And three, shows that there's people within the institution who are frustrated by how it's being covered up and by how it's being suppressed and are now felt that they had no choice but to go to the co-equal branch of Congress and to the one guy who protects and champions whistleblowers.
Right. I want you to hear what Brett Tolman said, what this could be. As you know, he's a U.S. attorney. Cut nine. It was.
A document like this really comes down to one thing in my mind, and this is probably an FBI 302 investigative report. I say that because the whistleblower, in order to make the connection and to assess that it's credible information like Senator Grassley has assessed, means that they had to have sat down with whoever's providing the information, and you're not going to do that without making sure you get every detail you can from someone.
So, well, I mean, if you want to see bias right there, if you classify a document rather than make it public, as opposed to during the Trump years, everybody knows the FBI was leaking, according to a high-level source of the FBI, X, Y, and Z, the Russia investigation, the first impeachment, the January 6th investigation. You know all that stuff. It was a direct line to the Washington Post and New York Times.
Yeah, it's you know, the FBI's credibility is in tatters. And if you look at the polls, people don't trust the FBI. People believe that there's full-out politics in their investigation. And they've, you know, this administration has got to really, you know, because this is not, of course, should not be decided in the White House. It should be decided in the Justice Department. The Justice Department has to decide whether are we really going to go and try and totally tank the credibility of the FBI. So, you know, when Donald Trump goes out and says something like, you know, we need to defund the FBI, most people say, good Lord, that's ridiculous, right? But more and more stuff like this comes out, and people start taking that, not defunding, but they just start, you know, the credibility of the organization is, and there's more calls for restructuring and all the rest of it. So I think they need to be transparent now that this has come out. And if they're not, then people are going to just, you know, this whole idea that there's a deep state out there that is trying to tank conservatives just gains more and more credibility the more they cover up.
So it looks like Ron DeSantis, if you watch some of the Super PAC ads, no doubt about it, he's getting in. And it looks like he's going to announce an exploratory committee within 2 weeks, and then he's probably going to get in June. Will it be too late? I know you're right today that DeSantis, what DeSantis has done, you don't worry if you're DeSantis, you're down by about 36 points on the net last CBS poll.
No, because, and first of all, he hasn't even declared his candidacy. He hasn't even started campaigning. What has Ron DeSantis been doing for the last 6 months primarily?
Working.
He's been passing like a juggernaut of conservative reform. Let me just give you a list of what Ron DeSantis has done in Florida since he won re-election by 20 points. He's passed the most comprehensive school choice law in the country. He protected the Second Amendment rights of Florida citizens with constitutional carry legislation, signed a law cracking down on trial lawyers, protecting Floridians from left-wing bail reform. He passed a law reducing the number of jurors needed to impose capital punishment and made child rape eligible for capital punishment. He signed legislation barring ESG investing of state assets, enacted laws to prohibit abortion after the heartbeat is detectable, and also to expand support for parents and parenting. And he's taking on Disney's crony capitalism. I mean, this is just in a few months. So while everybody's out there, you know, say, oh, Ron DeSantis isn't, you know, focused on the presidential campaign. No, what he's doing is he's focused on delivering victory after victory after victory for conservatives on fundamental policy issues that we care about. And so he's going to now turn around after this legislative session is done and say, hey, do you want me to do the same thing in Washington? Imagine if I win in November 2024, by this time in the spring of 2025, the list of things that we could have done. And mm-hmm. I'm going to do that for you. And I've proven it because I've done it. So I just think that he's this hasn't even started yet. And if he falls, you know, the field is shaping up nicely because some people are deciding, look, I don't see a path to victory. You know, in the olden days, they might have just gotten in anyway and you know, see if they can use it to raise their profile, but they're not. So it's a limited number of candidates. We're going to find what we got. The Republicans who don't want Trump to be the nominee need to look at, you need to settle on one nominee to compete with, no one candidate to compete against him. And they've got about 6 months to do it. And then we'll see what happens.
Well, you remember, Mark, I don't have to tell you, but our audience might have forgotten that after South Carolina, there was a massive dropout from Mayor Pete to Klobuchar to Elizabeth Warren. They basically said, listen, you can't win. We need you to leave. And they left. Everybody really left after that.
Well, because the Democrats play team sports, and Republicans don't. That's the big problem. But here's the other thing, is that everyone seems to think that Trump is so insurmountable. CBS poll this week came out. 24% of Republicans say they will only consider Trump as the GOP nominee. 49% say they're considering both Trump and other candidates. And then another 27% they're saying they're not considering Trump at all. What that means is 76% of the GOP electorate is gettable. There's a segment that is not considering Trump, and then among the people who say they right now who say they support Trump, more than half of those people are soft supporters who could be convinced to go with somebody else. So this thing is a jump ball.
Mark Thiessen with us. Mark, couple of things. I'm really impressed with Trump's team. They keep their heads down. They're not looking to do a bunch of surrogate interviews. They're contacting all the states. They're staying in contact. The ads are solid. And the president has been keeping his powder dry. He's not doing 100 interviews. He's not contradicting himself. He is sitting back. He's letting this horrible trial play out, this rape trial. Joe Tacopina seems like he's doing a terrible job, to be honest. But it's going to come and it's going to go. Oh, he's going to win or he's going to lose. He's keeping his profile down. They told him not to do Truth Social. He hasn't. And I think that his team understands that Ron DeSantis is the number one threat and they're attacking, but it's not necessarily coming from him. And if he was able to get a fair deal on these other town halls, those are the types of things you do if you want to change the outcome of your last election.
Yeah. I mean, well, look. We've been waiting for, you know, 6 years for Trump to show he can be disciplined. So maybe he is finally. Well, I don't know. I'm skeptical. He hasn't been very disciplined.
I know. But the thing is about you. He really respects you, and he'll reach out to you.
I respect him. But here's the thing. I am not a never Trumper. I've never, been a never Trumper. My problem is with Donald Trump is I don't think he can win. And I think that's the argument that could cost him the nomination. It's not going after him like Chris Christie is saying, oh, he didn't deliver on school choice and he didn't deliver, you know, he didn't build the border wall. Everybody looks at, of course, the Democrats stopped the border wall. He didn't repeal Obamacare. Well, yeah, John McCain. I mean, you know, no one's going to buy that. He was a great president. The problem is with Trump is that and what we saw in the 2020 election and the 2022 midterms is he's irreparably alienated swing voters. And Republican primary voters are not going to decide the next election.
Right.
Their support is important, but you have to be able to win over swing voters. And what DeSantis did in Florida that Trump didn't do in the White House is he won over people who didn't support him the first time. He made their lives better, and then he asked for their vote. And Donald Trump made people's lives better, but instead of winning over their votes, he drove them away. So to the point that people who said they thought they were better off now than they were 4 years ago, right before the 2020 election, still didn't vote for Trump.
And everything you said is correct, Mark.
And everything after the election has solidified that decision. And so I don't know that that's fixable at this point.
But do you know everything you said is correct? But the only thing that I would say is if there was no pandemic, that once in a three generation pandemic, as the last one was 19, he wins 4 more years.
Despite all the media being against him. If he had won the election, then there would have been no January 6th.
Exactly.
So, you know, there's a lot of what ifs. You know, but you're 100% right. He was cruising to re-election, especially after that first impeachment, which was such a debacle. You know, people thought that was political. They were behind him. The Mueller report was a disgrace. So, you know, I have no hostility towards Donald Trump. I think he was one of the greatest conservative presidents of my lifetime. But he can't win. And so the question becomes, do you care more about avenging Trump or do you care more about defeating Biden? And if Biden wins, the risks are so high, because if Biden wins another term, look, he's gonna be 86 by the time he leaves. If you just look at the actuarial tables, you know what the odds are of surviving to 85? 46%. So that means we got about a 60% chance that Kamala Harris becomes the president of the United States. Are you willing to risk that?
These are very good ads. I mean, that's a very good point. And I will say this. This is to the Trump people. When you attack Kayleigh McEnany as anti-Trump, when you start vilifying her because you used to work with him and saying things, you have really lost your way. And you're being absolutely a knucklehead. And when I see all these people going after other people who are, I guess, MAGA supporters, because they might say, you know, that Nikki Haley made a lot of sense in that speech, or the Disney, I like what DeSantis did on Disney. I think Trump's wrong on that. Next thing you know, it is total chaos. And Kayleigh McEnany, when you make Kayleigh McEnany the enemy and you're a Trump supporter, you really have to get an adjustment and go see a therapist. Oh, yeah. It's out there. And it's amazing to me. Joe Rogan pointed out she was the best press secretary he's ever seen.
Yeah, since Dana Perino.
Oh, yeah, sorry about that. But that was a totally different time. I'm so glad Dana's not listening to the radio now. She's on television. I'm going to deny I said that. And if you see Ari Fleischer, you never did my show. You don't even know I'm on the air.
There you go.
Mark, thanks so much. Great column. He wrote a column today. DeSantis made himself a conservative juggernaut. What has Trump done? A lot of great facts in that. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, we're going to take a short time out. Come back. And then Richard Dreyfuss will be in at the bottom of the hour of a whole half hour. His message is one you got to hear, and I think you agree with. His book is now out. One Thought Scares Me. We teach our children what we wish them to know. We don't teach our children what we don't wish them to know. The Academy Award-winning actor is coming your way. Don't move.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
His book is called One Thought Scares Me. He's one of the most famous actors of our generation, and I include myself in that. Richard Dreyfuss is here. Richard, this will be a short saying. We've got a whole half hour. Then we're going to talk on TV. But thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your mission right now for our audience is going to be what? What do you want to get across to them?
Well, on a personal level, I would say everyone who thinks that I'm a liberal should hear that I am not a liberal. I am a libo, conservo, rado, middle of the rodo, just like most of you. You just haven't given it any thought lately.
And guess what? You're very pro-American. I know we're not perfect, but you love the country you're in, and you're, like me, concerned that a lot of people here don't appreciate it.
Right, right. Of both sides, there is not one villain. There's a mindset that creates villainy.
And people should understand, this. You answer this question, which you put out there. What happens to the world if there's no America?
Right.
There is no substitute.
When America fails, and it will fail, what then?
Right. We got to make sure it doesn't. All right.
Right.
So listen. So Richard, we brought him in early just to say hello. And this way, when we come back, we have the whole half hour to talk about your illustrious career, your new book, and your mission. It's the same mission of our audience. I'll let people know how special it is to be here. You hit lotto when you got here, but you have to show your appreciation and work to keep it here.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Who is Joe Biden's vice president?
I have honestly no idea. Ooh, great question. No idea.
Tamara. What is it?
Kamala Harris.
Go stay here.
Can you name the three branches of government?
Republican, Democrat, and then I think moderate. Legislation, judicial, and consecutive. I don't know.
So that is an example. We brought the microphones out and we asked people some basic things. You see it on some of the late night shows too. That was for Jesse Waters' show, just about how little people know about what's going on in the news today, and certainly about history. Richard Dreyfuss with us now, Academy Award winning actor and author of One Thought Scares Me. We teach our children what we wish them to know. We don't teach our children what we don't wish them to know. And Richard, great to see you in studio.
Thank you.
If you're watching Fox Nation, you recognize him from every film that was any good. So Richard, you were listening to that. And what did you just tell me?
They were going to blame the kids and not really aim correctly, because it's what they're taught and what they're not taught. And teachers are not the guilty party, but it's the policymakers who say, don't teach that. And school boards. And you cannot blame teachers and then, of course, pay them like kitchen help. You have to really commit to an honest history. And when you do that, you have to live up to it. And that means every sin we've ever committed, and we have committed sins, every sin we've committed, every grand gesture we've committed, we have to have the same bragging rights
right.
for those as we have for telling the truth about
yeah.
our past.
So if you just move a little closer to the microphone, that would make Eric happy. So, Richard, I'm reading your book, and you talk about you're concerned people don't understand how great this country is. We
right.
never said you're perfect, but you grew up, you personally love reading history,
yeah.
love reading about our past. It's fascinating. There's no history quite like it.
Right.
It doesn't mean we walk on water and that Jefferson was perfect and that Washington never made a mistake, but the world is a better place because America exists.
Yes.
And you're concerned, like I am, that people might not realize that live here.
Well, you have the one day I was watching Denise D'Souza on Mike Huckabee, and he was saying that he had written a book called America, What the World Would Be Like Without Us. And I got up, went to the bookstore, bought the book, came back home, read the book, and then went grumpy, because in his book he didn't answer his title. He had named it, but he didn't get anywhere near answering it. So they called me that day, Mike, and said, you want to come down and be on the show? And I said, yes. And I walked in, and there was a D'Souza, and I said, what did you think? And I said, I'm very confused and frustrated because you had an incredibly provocative title. And I want to see that world because I think that would be an incredible history class. What would the world be like without us? Wow. But you didn't. All you did was say how great we were. You didn't compare it.
But yeah, I think if Dinesh D'Souza, I think in a way he's saying, look at how we changed the world by our existence, how many democracies had come from there, giving people a say in their government.
But you see, they don't know that there was a change. So that wasn't the thoughtful conclusion of their thinking. They didn't. He didn't compare it to anything. He just described how great we were. And if he had compared it to any country, whether it was England or Russia or China or whoever, that would have been of some value.
Gotcha. So what do you want to get across to our listeners right now?
Well, a lot of things, but there was a revolution. And there's a revolution only when you turn the values of the entire world on their head. And that's what we did. We turned the power of the sovereign, kicked the sovereign out, and handed that power to all of the people. And that was not only not done, that was as revolutionary a move as you can possibly create. And we risked the nation on that idea that we could confidently educate our poorest and educate our most enslaved, and they would be smart enough to run the country or to create art or to create this or that. And they were out to create intellectual resource pools. And know that the people swimming around in those pools were all going to be smart enough to be president or senator, yep, or something. And they weren't ever educated that well. And I would say they tried to and gave it a good shot for a long time. And then after World War II, they said, I don't think it's good to risk our children on this anymore. And they threw it away.
Who's they?
Educators. Educators and politicians.
And you write in your book that after World War II, it's our zenith. You know, we freed the world, we beat the bad guys, we led right. The world, and we rebuilt the places that we blew up.
That's right.
With the Marshall Plan.
And we didn't brag about it. We did it. We did good things, not talked about them. And all over the world, people admired us for all the right reasons. And before you could blink, they had removed civics, the study of the Constitution, the study of the Bill of Rights, the birth tale of America. These things had always been taught. And now they were not, they didn't disappear. They were turned over to social studies, which is one floor up and in the back of the building.
So interesting. Yeah.
And they were turned from actual events in our history to a gentle panorama as a description of our way of life.
And I remember one politician came out recently and said, you know, America was never that great, you know, and maybe contrast to a president that said, America, make America great again. But what I always think is people think when you say a country is great, it's perfect. And you make clear in your first words in your book, you never said that. But I think what makes us great, these are my words, is that we try to be, that we try to make it better. We identify it when party identifies, another party identifies, and we try to make it better. Was slavery right? Absolutely not. Do we fight a war to fix it? Yes. Is Jim Crow terrible? Absolutely. Is there black and white water fountains now in the South? Are people telling them to go to the back of the buses? No. We owned up to it. Riots in the streets. It wasn't pleasant. It wasn't pretty. But we fixed it. And we, again, are still this country that wants to be better and better. And you're concerned that we don't understand that.
We don't want the same things we used to want. And I hope to God we relearn that ambition and relearn that goal. Because I have seen audiences acquire outrage on their faces when you describe what's happened. And they're outraged that their children are not getting what they should.
Well, they come back with negative things about
us. And I have seen those same parents have outrage disappear from their faces before they get to their car. And the commitment of making it work disappears. And what is that commitment? It's the commitment to the idea that Jefferson wrote that said that these people, we are the sovereign power in this country. We have the same power in collective as the monarch and the sovereign. Now, do we know that? Do we act on that? Or in some sick alchemic way, when we vote and we're voting some guy in, he thinks he's been made our boss. And he's not only not our boss, but somehow we've got to get across to him.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't listen to your constituency, if you don't listen to us who put you there, we will rip you out of that office so fast you would not blink.
Right.
And they are absolutely impervious to that because they know that we don't have the guts or the knowledge to do it.
So also, Richard Dreyfuss, our guest, you recognize the voice, of course. If you're not watching Fox Nation, you're not seeing them. But we're privileged to have him here. He's also got the Dreyfuss Civics Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization launched in 08. It aims to revive the teaching of civics in American public education to empower future generations with the critical thinking skills they need to fulfill the vast potential of American citizenship. It's up to all our responsibilities to do it. Now, amongst us, Richard, there's been some great presidents along the way that we didn't know were great at the time. Like, look at Harry Truman. Name me a top five category when they rank presidents. He's not great or near great along the way.
Right.
The guy's a farmer, you know.
Right.
With everything of Andrew Jackson, the big plus is this guy is a self-made success story. He was basically an orphan by 13. No other country does that happen. It wasn't the ruling class of Jefferson, Monroe, and Washington, and Madison. Then all of a sudden you get an outsider who's president because he campaigned and he went to the people.
Well, you can create a list. It starts with Thomas Jefferson, and it ends somewhere in the 20th century. And it's the list of those presidents who happened to be in office when there was a crisis and every other branch of government was closed for the summer or closed, we've gone fishing, so that Thomas Jefferson had to create a navy to answer the Tripoli pirates, and Lincoln had to do what he did in order to respond to the Southern secession.
So, and I think it's so important, too. Nobody would have predicted that Lincoln was going to amount to be this great leader.
Right.
Only in this country does it happen. And when you talk about Thomas Jefferson, this guy didn't want to get a platoon together to help fight a militia together to help fight the war.
Yeah.
But he ends up telling Adams, I need this navy, and we're going to have to tell the whole world we're willing to fight for our freedom. And had to send a message.
Yep.
An unlikely person, a great intellect.
A guy who would have voted against that navy in a second. And yet, because he was president, he knew what he had to do.
Right. And I'll bring you to another one that I think you could appreciate and you brought up before the show, Sam Houston. Sam Houston is a guy that was not achieving much as a kid. His brothers were much more enterprising, joins the military, finds a mentor in Jackson, has some problems. He drank too much for a while, had a problem with his marriage. Governor would just leave and with the American Indians. But then at the right person at the right time, when the war's about to start in the South, he's like, we're not going to do well. We should not get into this war. And they said, hey, if you don't vote for this war as governor, you're out. And he's like, I quit. So he left rather than fight for the South in the breakup of a country. That's character.
Yes, that's character. And we don't even think to include that in our little list of checks and boxes. And what do we care about? If we cared about character, we would not have had the last number of presidents. And I actually called Larry King one day. And I normally don't do this, but I called Larry and I said, I want to be on your show now. And he said, okay. And I went down there and I said, I'm not a partisan, and you know that.
Hey, Richard, why don't you hold that story? We're going to take a short time out and come back. We have a few minutes on the other side. Richard Dreyfuss is here. His book is now out. You got to pick it up, especially if you're a parent. And it is One Thought Scares Me. We'll talk more about it when we return.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So when we left, Richard Dreyfuss, the Academy Award-winning actor who has a passion for this country, whose book is now out called One Thought Scares Me, was about to say why he called up Larry King and said, I'm coming down. Now, by the way, it's good to be Richard Dreyfuss. How many people can call the number one talk show at the time and say, put me on?
I had a separate reputation because I was a new celebrity and I loved to talk politics. And I wasn't afraid of talking politics. And so I was always being asked to do that. And there's a story about me and Dick and Rumsfeld that will curl your hair.
Okay.
But this one was that I called Larry and I said, I want to appear on your show now. And he said, okay. And I came down there and I said, I want you to understand important that this is not a political statement, that this is not about politics or political principle. This is about the man, Trump, who I am opposed to, because he has no simple common decency.
And what year is this?
2016. And I said, you have to ask yourself a question if you're impressed by Donald Trump. Imagine him calling you and saying that he's in love with your daughter and he wants to marry her.
Right.
Would you be willing to say yes to Donald Trump being your son-in-law? Not your president, your son-in-law. And I must say, I think America has more than enough morality in its back story to be able to stand up and say, never.
Right. So you did not vote for Trump. That's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
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 Have you voted for a Republican?
I have.
Yeah?
I have, and I would. I got no problem with that.
As
a matter of fact, I would say that had he not taken it, I would have called myself a compassionate conservative. And I come from the left.
And that's pretty much what George W. Bush ran on.
Yeah, and I would have used that phrase, but he had used it first. And so I could not do that. But I'm against all of those phrases, all of those descriptions. I'm against them all. They mislead. They misunderstand. They make things simple when they're not.
Right.
They create an impression of simplicity and understandability when it's incomprehensibly complex.
So one thing I get from you, you're a patriot. You feel fortunate to be born here, and you're concerned that people don't appreciate it, and you're taking action.
Well, without America, yikes. I mean, just imagine 1945 without the United States of America.
Or 2023. And I still think, yeah.
Well, we need at least a dry cleaning. We need some humility.
We got it. Listen, we'll talk more about this on One Nation over the weekend. Richard, thanks so much for your time. Go out and pick up his book, One Thought Scares Me. Richard Dreyfuss, thank you.
The thought.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. 1-866-408-7669. Bob and the Yarrow, we're going to talk about this Ukraine war. The latest column with Eli Lake, Russia playing the victim on the Kremlin drone attack. Eli also is going to be helping us out with a Memorial Day special as we look back at the Iraq war. What would happen if we didn't go in? And he was there every step of the way, so he would know. And I think it's good for us to recalibrate where we were at as a country back then. And with me in studio is David Avella, GOPAC chairperson. Usually you're here, chairman, I should say. David, usually here when you do an outnumbered. Are you doing an outnumbered today?
I am.
Are you? Okay, he's all ready to go. So great to see you.
Great to see you. Thank you.
Republicans feel pretty good about Jim Justice getting in West Virginia. And Ben Cardin retiring, I thought would be a natural Larry Hogan going over there. So far, he doesn't want to do it, but he is so popular in Maryland, that could be a Republican seat if he got in.
Absolutely, it could be. But back to your Justice, I mean, there'll be a competitive primary there, and Governor Justice and then Congressman Alex Mooney, who Club for Growth has pledged $10 million to help get him the nomination.
Not Jim Justice?
Not Jim Justice.
That's interesting.
But Jim Justice is not going to lack for resources either, being he's West Virginia's only billionaire. So it will be a well-funded on both sides, and whoever comes out of it has a really strong chance of beating Joe Manchin and getting us a seat to put us towards majority.
Many people think that Manchin's not going to run.
Brian, as you and I have discussed, I have followed Joe Manchin my entire career. I actually started working in the West Virginia State Legislature, and it was the senator I worked for shared a area with Joe Manchin's office. So I have watched him his entire career, and to think we know what he's going to decide, I think the best thing is to follow what he said, which is he's going to make a decision in December.
The Inflation Reduction Act is the biggest mystery ever to me, because it was so obvious. The stuff that he wanted can't be in that act anyway because it was done on reconciliation. So he had to go on their word that they were going to honor what they promised him. And they didn't honor it, and he didn't have Republican votes because he was so angry about about drilling and permitting and things like that nature. So he feels like he's been totally let down. It was supposed to be $380 billion. It's around $1 trillion. How you have an act that's triple what you said it was and have it be constitutional is astounding. But besides that, he stopped us from adding two states. He stopped the end of the filibuster.
You bring up the great Joe Manchin in that he worked. He was the key vote that got that bill passed. And now it's an election year. He sees it's a bad bill. So now he's going to work to undo it. As much as Joe Manchin can be a good vote from time to times, he is ultimately a reliable vote for Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden. And you think about major pieces of legislation, whether it was tax bills, whether it was health care bills, whether it was infrastructure bills. Joe Manchin has been there to support the Biden administration lock, stock, and barrel.
But he has stopped some other crazy things of packing the court. He says it's a non-starter.
You know how we stopped the Biden agenda even more? Put a Republican in the U.S. Senate from West Virginia.
But I'm just saying during that time, there's always been plenty of Republicans who went against Trump.
Sure.
But there's not been many Democrats to go against the Democratic president.
Let's have a reliable vote who will stop this Biden craziness.
Well, I'm biased. I think Jim Justice is one of the greatest guys I've met. I just think he's a lot of fun, self-made success story, so bold, and I think just personable. It was also, I hear he's a great basketball coach.
Yes.
High school basketball coach.
Women's basketball coach.
Yeah,
fact,
and he tried to get the boys,
team.
Too.
Yeah.
So I just love these multitaskers who does what he does. And I understand he's a great golfer in college, captain of the Marshall golf team. But let's just talk more about the Senate for a second. Have you seen a challenge to Senator Tester? Is there someone out there that you think can beat him? Because he does have fundamental Montana support.
It's pretty widely known that former or current congressman, our nominee last time, Matt Rosendale, is going to give another shot at or certainly thinking about running again. And then there's one or two others that are thinking about running against Tester. Tester's no easy out, as he showed from the last few elections. We've had good nominees against him.
He never votes. He votes with the Democratic line all the time. Never
agreed.
Stood up to anything. Manchin and Sinema are the ones to stand up and take the bullets, even though he probably wouldn't have voted for it.
But he goes home and plays that I am a conservative fighting against Washington.
But he doesn't.
hopefully we can do a better job of exposing that.
We're on WHIO in Ohio, and Sherrod Brown is going to do the best he can to sound like a moderate in Ohio, which is done reliably red. Mm-hmm. What have you seen about his chances of any Republican chances of unseating him?
Well, let's keep in mind that for all the talk that Ohio is a swing state, it's not. And now you're down to really just Sherrod Brown. And whether it be Secretary of State Frank LaRose, who's thinking about running, Matt Dolan, who ran last time, is thinking about running, we will have a strong nominee this time. And we're going to give Sherrod Brown a good run for his money this time.
And I think overall the theme will be, the big story will be, and it's already been mapped out there, is MAGA conservatives, extreme, and they want to make abortion illegal. The Republicans have had now about a year to try to get that message out. What is the right message on abortion?
The right message on every politician, elected official, has to decide where they are. Ultimately, Supreme Court has said it's going to be determined by the states. And what you're seeing, Brian, across the country is states led by Republicans are putting more pro-life policies in place, and states led by Democrats are putting more pro-choice policies. And if that is your driving issue, people tend to line up and move to states where they have policies that they like. And that, in some ways, that's what you're seeing happening right now.
But in the states that you need, and the ones in the midterms, I mean, in my humble opinion, Joe Biden's party would have been routed in the midterms if it wasn't for Roe v. Wade being overturned.
Joe Biden's party would have been routed had we given voters an agenda that independents could have said, we want that instead of.
What do you mean?
And we Republicans believe last cycle that if we just told people how bad Joe Biden was, that would be enough. And we weren't strong enough until the very end. Luckily, when Speaker McCarthy came out with his commitment to America to talk about what we were for, we didn't spend enough time talking about what we would have we'd do differently federally. You look at what we did, though, at the state level. Brian Kemp took out a big star in Stacey Abrams. We had in every state where we had a Republican, almost every state we had a Republican majority, we gained seats in the state legislatures because we talked about what we were for. At the federal level, we have to accept that it's more than just talking about how bad Joe Biden is. We have to present an agenda for folks and have them say that's what we want.
I want you to hear with Chuck Grassley. This is pretty big news that came across yesterday. For the longest time, we watched the Biden family business, and obviously President Trump felt as though they were corrupt and got impeached for it, almost fulfilled. And Rudy Giuliani was out there going to investigate. But now you have the cover of the New York Post today. Talk about a whistleblower that's come forward. They call it a stunning development, but the House Oversight Committee issued a subpoena Wednesday for an FBI file that a whistleblower said links President Biden himself as vice president to a criminal scheme involving money for policy decisions. Absolutely third rail for any party and any American. Can you imagine if people thought that you were sacrificing America's interests so you could make a little bit of money? What can you tell us about that?
It is important that the FBI and prosecutors treat this whistleblower as credible as they treat whistleblowers when it comes against Republicans, and that partisan investigations from the left are no better than partisan investigations from the right. And if we have evidence, it needs to be presented. It needs to be taken seriously. It needs to be looked at. And if crimes were committed, people need to be prosecuted.
Here's Chuck Grassley. Cut one.
We have credible information that this possible criminal activity took place. And I can't verify whether or not it's really a criminal activity, but I do have faith in the whistleblowers that bring it to me that this document exists. We have a rough idea of what's in the document, and I just want to do what congressional oversight responsibilities I have to see what the FBI's and the DOJ's done to follow up on it.
So we know that Hunter Biden's had dealings with this Russian mayor and the family, Devin Archer, the partner of Hunter Biden. We know that Jeff Cooper had lunch. Jeff Cooper was the partner of Hunter Biden, and they had lunch with the vice president at the time, Carlos Slim, one of the richest people in the world. The president visited Mexico. They wonder if it was Romania. Breakfast with Dad was on the schedule. A Romanian businessman, Gabriel Papavaciu, in early 2015. They were going to help him. Hunter Biden was his lawyer, go figure, to help him challenge a corruption conviction. And then next thing you know, November 15th of next year, they're having breakfast with the vice president, China and CEFC. We have looked at the five public deals that he's had that has many people raising their eyebrows. This could be the answer there.
It could. The key word of Chuck Grassley's answer there is we need to verify. And if we verify, Americans are going to say, look, we need to prosecute accordingly. That's what they want. They want justice based off facts. But look at the bigger picture here for this White House, that now they have to deal with an increasingly obvious investigation that must occur into this. At the same time, when they're trying to deal with the debt limit, they're trying to deal with the border issue. And that as this continues to mount and more things come on this White House's plate, this becomes a big distraction for them.
When you look at 2024 and you see how Glenn Youngkin says, I'm not running, and Mike Pompeo says, I won't be in, it doesn't look like Kristi Noem. A year ago, we were speculating that all these guys are getting in. It looks like Pence in inevitability, DeSantis in inevitability, and Tim Scott's a week away. How is this shaping up in your mind?
Well, let's keep in mind, Youngkin said he's not running now. He's not running this year. He hasn't ruled out that should, you know, next year he could change his mind in subsequent comments that he has made. He's not running right now. So could he get in if he sees that the field—
Oh, I didn't know there was a clarification. Did he go out of his way to clarify? Because
in a day or so later, there was some comments that he said he's not running now. That doesn't mean he's not going to run down the road. Along those lines was his comment. Look, right now, we have a field that is President Trump is the clear front runner, and then many candidates will get their opportunity to show that they should be the nominee and not President Trump. Right now, DeSantis is the one that everybody has a focus on, and he'll either emerge or he won't. And if he doesn't, then it gives someone else a chance, just as we saw in 2016 when, as President, then candidate Trump got himself into front runner status. Remember, he wasn't the front runner in the very beginning, and he worked his way to become that. And then we went through a series of folks. If you didn't want Trump, did you want Cruz or did you want Walker or did you want Bush? And that'll happen again this cycle.
When you look at people who come out and say, yeah, Trump can win the nomination, but he can't win the general because moderates won't listen and suburban women have checked out.
It's laughable to say we'll know the political environment next November. And ultimately, we don't know what's going to happen between now and then.
We know a recession could be looming. We know the Title 42 is about to evaporate. We know a debt ceiling is going to be hit in a month. We know that he's got 34% approval rating on his economy, which he's been bragging about. Those are facts.
You know, I always remind Republicans that, you know, ultimately President Trump got the nomination and then went on and won the nomination because he talked about how he was a businessman who knew how to create jobs, that he wanted to secure the border, that he was going to stand up to Washington. And that got him not only through the primary, but ultimately led to his election. And I say all that to say this. What the president did in 2016 was present an agenda of what he would do in office more than just he was against Hillary Clinton. Whoever our nominee is in 2024
has to think optimistically.
Has to think optimistically about what the future is going to hold and how they're going to get us there. It's more than just talking about how bad Biden is. Look, 80% of Americans don't want Biden to run again. The reality is we only get to pick from the people actually on the ballot.
54% of Democrats don't want him to.
That's right. And so we're in a position to be able to win in 24. We just have to give voters a reason to vote for us.
Right. David Avell is here, GOPAC chairman and GOP strategist, obviously. When we come back, we'll talk about what that vision looks like. And then Eli Lake at the bottom of the hour. There are some developments in the Russian war. And there's a lot of optimism for Ukrainians, pro-Ukrainians, that they're going to make big progress this spring. Dare I say, they have to. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. David Avell is here. He's going to be on. He's going to be the man in the middle. I'm outnumbered shortly. He's the GOPAC chairperson, GOP strategist, chairman, GOP strategist. David, you did mention something to me in the break that I found interesting. You believe almost all stats reveal that we're becoming more and more divided. That more and more people say, no gas ovens in New York. I'm going to Florida. Taxes are going to continue to go up. I'm going to where the problem. I'm going to go to Texas, and more people in California are actually going to other places. But for the most part, are you concerned that we're dividing among the states that we agree with? Isn't that the way we've always been?
That is a growing trend that ultimately Americans are moving to get to policies that they're in favor of. That's why you see states like New York and California and Illinois losing population. If you looked at some of the tax data that came out last week and the billions that New York is losing to Florida and Texas and Tennessee. And
so they raised taxes more.
In those states?
And made people want to leave.
Oh, made them want to leave here. That's right.
But so when they leave, the revenue goes down, so they're going to raise taxes again.
At some point, it comes all crashing down, right? But that's why you see the growth states being those led by Republicans that are seeing. And ultimately, what does that mean long-term politically? Well, it means states like Florida and Texas and Tennessee and North Carolina are going to get more seats, and they're electing Republicans. So you're going to see in these growing trend that Congress becomes more Republican, arguably, at least in the House.
But what you will have, too, is these urban environments are falling apart. So to me, it's not, well, if you have a Republican running Chicago, it's different. If you have a Republican running of New York, it's different. There's no city, it seems, where there's a Republican mayor. So when you guys sit around and you strategize, do you think about what is our urban strategy, or do you just give up on the urban strategy?
Well, we do have to give a shout out to the Republican mayor of Jacksonville in Oklahoma City, where we do have two Republican mayors. No, you can't give up on the big cities. Absolutely not. They are as much a part of America as the rural areas. But it is why you're seeing increasing number in Republican states, state legislatures stepping in and saying to prosecutors in the big cities, you actually have to enforce the law. It's why you see down in Florida, the Governor DeSantis getting more active, that if prosecutors aren't going to enforce the law, they're going to step in.
Right.
But it's in addition to the elected officials, you also have to look at some of the coalitions within the Democratic Party. Think about this, Brian. We were talking about it. In Colorado, the teachers union just passed a resolution to say capitalism is an exploitation of children and of schools.
Did not know that.
We wonder about why schools, we see that now 13% of kids can't talk about U.S. history. We see math scores are down, science scores are down, spelling's down. Well, when our focus isn't on the key reading, writing, and arithmetic, that's why we get where we are.
I just hope, though, a lot of times things have to change when they get really bad. And my hope is the Republicans get a strategy in there just to make it, to say, this is my vision of your city, rather than just saying, we can't win there, so why compete there? So, David, good luck on Outnumbered.
Thank you.
Hopefully you have a good group.
Hopefully I'll be as smart as you.
Well, you know what? That's a goal, but I can't guarantee it.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, Ukraine does have drones that can fly this far. They have fired drones. Ukraine is about 460 miles from Moscow. That is Kiev. So it would be maybe a 400-mile flight. It would be difficult. It's possible this could have been staged by Ukrainian operatives close to Moscow. Mm-hmm. But look, the blowback, if this failed, would have been severe. And I think the Ukrainian government is much more careful to do something so reckless and clumsy. I really don't think they did it.
And they're denying they did it. And they're talking about, that's Fred Flights. He has a he was former assistant national security advisor to John Bolton, and he's been in a few administrations, doesn't think there's really much of a chance that a drone from Ukraine was there to kill Vladimir Putin. Why would they do that? Eli Lake, contributing editor of Commentary Magazine, columnist for the New York Sun, host of Reeducation Podcast, weighs in. Eli, do you believe that the Ukrainians are taking a shot at Putin?
No, I do not. I think that if you look at the video, the drones themselves do not look like military-grade drones that could have traveled the distance from Ukrainian territory. And there have been a number of reports in Moscow and the kind of suburban areas of Moscow of drones just sort of in the sky and often falling out of the sky. I think this was either a group of kind of kids, because this was, by the way, the idea that this was an assassination attempt is ludicrous. The drones were too small to carry any kind of significant payload in that regard. And the Ukrainians know, like everybody else, that Vladimir Putin actually rarely spends any time in the Kremlin. So I think what we're seeing here is a kind of scramble from the Russian side to come up with either a pretext for their next kind of round of attacks in Ukraine, or just sort of a message in some ways to their own population to justify a war that they are clearly losing.
So do you think they're fearing the surge that's coming their direction?
Well, the counteroffensive, the Ukrainian, I mean, right now, you know, the Russians have a fairly advantageous position in the sense that the Ukrainians rarely have at least open, there have been no open attacks by Ukraine inside of Russia. There may have been a Ukrainian hand in the attack that killed the daughter of one of the chief Russian propagandists, Alexander Dugin. There may have been a Ukrainian role in the sabotage of the pipeline, Nord Stream 2. All of that's possible, but it's also possible there are other people who have, you know, motivations. You could see that being the Russians as well. I'm not yet convinced by Cy Hirsch's reporting on the pipeline, but I'm not ruling it out. But I don't think, you know, there's any evidence at this point that the Russians have anything to fear in terms of, in their own territory, a serious Ukrainian reprisal. It's the counteroffensive in Ukraine is going to be against the Russian military positions that are have invaded their country. And there's a huge difference there.
So the surge, they have about 18% of the country right now. The surge to get their country back is poised to go now that the spring's here. Most of the tanks, I think, that are going to arrive have arrived. The strategy is probably in place. So do you think the Russians fear what the Ukrainians are about to do?
I think they do fear. I think the military certainly fears. So the military has been bested, and now we're dealing with third-tier Russian conscripts a lot of the times who are on these front lines. It's really a cannon fodder kind of operation. The main damage that the Russians are doing in Ukraine are the indiscriminate firing of missiles and lethal drones. You know, and everything. We've all seen the footage: apartment buildings, schools, hospitals, etc. So I think that the Russians are concerned. Remember, here's something else to kind of keep in mind. There was a huge rush of stories about 2 months ago, if you remember, about China possibly stepping up its support for Russia and providing arms. We haven't seen that yet. That's interesting. And that I'm not saying that's because of brilliant, you know, Biden administration diplomacy. I don't think that's necessarily it. I think it might be that Xi is looking at this and, like anyone who's making a kind of, you know, big geostrategic decisions, he sees the Russian military as the kind of hollow Potemkin force that it is. And it's like throwing money, you know, good money after bad in some ways.
But they like us so distracted. Distracted using our armaments and depleting our resources. They love that.
That's true. And there is a concern if you talk to people in the defense industry that we have committed so much to the Ukrainian front that we need to make sure that we have stocks to deal with our other kind of obligations as well. But I always kind of come back to this point. If the United States if Ukraine loses and is forced into kind of a humiliating deal with Putin that allows him to consolidate the gains that he's, you know, from his illegal war, that is a kind of perverse incentive for the Chinese as well. What you want to sort of do with the Ukraine theater is to sort of make it a demonstration to the Chinese that if you try to make a move on Taiwan, there's a very good chance you will lose and you won't get what you want. And it's not as a simple a calculation as you may have thought. America and its allies are not as weak, are not as feckless.
I know. I just would have loved a better message from Macron to say, listen, I'm for you guys, but if you invent Taiwan, if you take over Taiwan, Europe is going to be united in alienating you. Instead, he said, I'm not going to get involved. How damaging was that?
That's not great. And I think it's a real problem. On the other hand, if you would have asked the French government before Putin's invasion of Ukraine, will there be a response like we've seen from Europe? I mean, we wouldn't have, you know, sometimes it takes a terrible thing to happen in order to really see the kind of response. So I was flabbergasted when I saw those comments from Macron. I thought it was totally unhelpful, and I don't understand what he's thinking. On the other hand, I also think that it's going to be a different matter if you see an invasion of Taiwan. And it's not just the French. I mean, think about what that's going to mean for the Japanese and other. I mean, China is going to have a serious pushback at, you know, not just militarily, but economically. I mean, it's going to be a real problem, I think, for China as well.
Right. They think, they always think long term. That's my worry. They think, well, we'll put up with this for 15 years and we don't care about our people anyway. But they're doing the best they can to try to consolidate the world against us, including that new trade group they're forming with.
Yeah, I'm not expanding. As worried about that, though. That, I think, is just a lot of bluster. There's so much. There's not really a great advantage of aligning economically with the Chinese. Just ask the Vietnamese. We were in a terrible war with them a generation ago, if you remember. And, you know, there were very legitimate grievances that the Vietnam nationalists would have with America. And they have deepened their cooperation with the United States because they know that it is totally a bad deal for, they will be supplicants. They will, you know, entirely if they try to align with China. I'm just not as worried about that because the experience of other countries that have tried to cozy up to the Chinese has been so bad. And the Chinese are so vicious in their kind of what they call debt diplomacy.
They're mobsters.
Yes,
they give you a loan you can't pay back, and then they take what you built.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I think the message is pretty clear that you get a much better deal with the United States. But the problem is that I'm worried that, you know, we've had now successive presidencies, really going back to Obama, where what's been the message from the American leadership in the world? I mean, you know, we have to kind of stand up for our values and act, you know, with more confidence. Well, that's really why it's so important that Ukraine beats back this Russian illegal war. Because I think that is the kind of thing that has the momentum to turn things around in that regard.
Eli Lake is with us, contributing editor of Commentary Magazine, columnist for the New York Sun. He's got a podcast called the Reeducation Podcast. So, Eli, let's talk about what this new story that now our State Department, which I have no faith in, and our Secretary of State, I think he's terrible, and Jake Sullivan, awful. I don't think they really love the country too much, personally, and I don't think that's a good starting point. But I will say this. They say they're now warming to the prospect of China playing a role in the peace effort. In what respect?
In what peace effort that they're warming
to the role of China in the peace effort with Russia and the Ukraine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I hope that that's not real. Oh, my God. Well, that's not a great idea. I mean, China is Russia's ally in this regard. And I just, you know, like, there needs to be a, you know, victory effort, and then we can talk about the terms of peace. This is the mistake, by the way, of all the modern presidents, is the idea that everybody has to think of an exit strategy in these conflicts when the exit strategy has to be defeat the invading army. That's the exit strategy. I don't understand. That's very troubling to kind of hear that. But again, I'm looking at the fact that the shoe hasn't dropped yet on the Chinese supplying the Russians in terms of their actual military materiel, as opposed to other ways the Chinese are helping Russia.
But the way it would turn up on the battlefield, if those leaks are correct, and they seem to be correct, is they'll look like civilian arms. They're not going to have the Chinese emblem on them, and they'll just appear.
Yeah, but we would have heard, because I think the United States has very good intelligence in terms of the Russian supply chain. So we would have known at this point, given that there was obviously a strategic leak before, that the Chinese were considering it. So it strikes me that we probably would have heard at this point, especially after the Discord leak. We probably would have known if the Chinese had followed through on that. That's my hunch.
So one thing that Vladimir Putin, you can honestly say, is a flat-out loss, is the expansion of NATO happened. He's upset about it. Well, they just added Finland. Now, Sweden's being held out by Turkey's vote. Turkey, Erdogan, is up for an election. He's also having a health scare. All six parties have combined in Turkey to fight against Erdogan, combine against him. But he is in control of the army. Where's that heading, and why is it important to all my listeners?
Well, first of all, it's very important because Turkey, even if it wasn't a member of NATO, is a very important country, and it has been for some time in terms of U.S. strategic interests. It's also important because Erdogan has played both sides of the Russia relationship. I mean, he has come to blows almost with Russian forces in Syria from a few years back. On the other hand, you know, he's purchased advanced air defense systems from the Russians. And he likes to have the option that he can always sort of say, I've got a foot in this other camp. Now, my view is that that's not tenable if Turkey wants to remain a NATO ally. And I'm concerned because, you know, since Erdogan's been in power, he's purged the leadership of his own military. So he's got loyalists there at high rank. So if there is this sort of six against one dynamic and he loses in the elections, will he cede power voluntarily? Yes. That is a huge question. And what will the military do in that particular situation? If we would have asked that question 10, 15 years ago, I really wouldn't have been worried because the Turkish military was a force for sort of stability in a lot of ways and was worried about the further Islamization of the country. Now, I don't think we have that kind of information and we have that kind of assurances from the Turkish military. So I'm concerned on that.
Yeah, it's just interesting what's taking place, too. And now you have a situation in the Middle East. Please explain to me how it's better off since Trump left. We decided to get back in the Iranian deal. Yeah, Middle East. Explain to me. We try to get back in the Iran deal, alienating Saudi Arabia. They started having a relationship now with Iran and with China. And Sudan was part of the Abraham Accords, has fallen apart. And now you have a situation where Israel is losing the Democratic Party here. Can you describe the Middle East that we're in now?
Well, I think that there is a I think that the Biden administration lost an opportunity. They always gave lip service to the Abraham Accords, and they said they would like to expand and follow on that. But they never did the things that were necessary in order to make that happen, which is to sort of keep a very tough line on Iran. It's amazing to me. We have now seen about 6 months of a significant uprising in Iran. You've seen President Biden and other officials kind of saying the right words in terms of American solidarity with that uprising in Iran. And yet they still will not give up this idea that they can eventually negotiate a deal with the people who they're uprising against, this regime that oppresses the Iranian people. So that's point number one. Point number two is it's one thing to say, you know, we'd like, you know, for Saudi Arabia to sort of stay in our orbit. But if you don't provide correct, proper leadership in the region diplomatically, then you're going to see
absolutely
other countries hedge their bets, which is what the Saudis just did. And we're seeing it now with Bashar al-Assad, the butcher of Syria. And lots of Arab countries are now going forward with normalizing relations with Assad. You know, even and the United States really is doing nothing about that. So it's I would say, yes, the situation in the Middle East is worse since Biden came into office.
There's a lot of people in the State Department not doing their job. They got to be fanned out and try to battle back everywhere using diplomacy, trade, American ingenuity as what they could bring to the table. But it doesn't seem like we have our hand anywhere effectively, especially in our own hemisphere. Eli Lake,
well, you know,
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Final thought.
You make a very good point really quickly, and that is on the basic first principle point that the United States needs to sort of say we're not interested in deals with decrepit dictatorships like Iran. And once you sort of put that off, and like Trump did, and you say we're out of the deal, lots more things can happen.
Exactly. It's going to be an interesting election cycle, and I wonder if people are going to pay attention enough because it matters so much. But we are looking to see if Ukraine can make some significant progress this spring and start getting their country back. It'll be very interesting to see where this thing goes. Eli Lake, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
All right. Always great. 1-866-408-7669. I'm going to try to squeeze in some calls or find out if there's more to know. Don't move.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. Thanks so much for listening. Keep in mind, 48 hours, One Nation, 8 o'clock Saturday night. Great roster of guests. I'll go over a little bit later. Let's find out if there's more to know.
More to know. Sponsored by Spirits Capital Corporation. Barreled Whiskey is the cash cow of industry insiders. But now you too can invest in premium American whiskey as it ages. Go to caskdeeds.com. CASKdeeds.com to learn more. Paid for by Spirits Capital Corporation.
Maria Menounos, you know, she's one of the nicest people you ever meet. Also one of the most attractive. Guess what? Secretly survived pancreatic cancer with excruciating abdominal pain while giving birth and expecting a child. She was diagnosed with stage 2 pancreatic cancer. I did not know this in January. They had to take out a tumor. She said, quote, I need people to know there are places that they can go to catch things early. You can't let fear get in the way. And she said, I was feeling good. Then I got slapped in the face with this. I'd scream out loud. It was unconscionable how much painful she was in. The actress comes after a doctor discovered the golf ball-sized tumor in her brain in 2017. She had surgery to remove that. Ultimately, that was benign. So I'm trying to figure out, did she have the kid? Menounos coached team, she did have it?
And also, remember, she also has type 1 diabetes, so she really is a survivor. And
unbelievable. Next, California's reparations panel to recommend a down payment to black residents. Really, the whole state's going broke, and now they're paying off black residents when they weren't even a part of the Civil War. Unbelievable. There was no slavery in California. Economists predicted in a preliminary estimate in March that California reparations plan would cost the state $800 billion. Good luck with that. Kansas City's become the latest Democratic-run city to form reparations commission seeking repayments for black residents. Next, Elon Musk has slashed Twitter. They're down to 1,000 employees. So they're down. Their workforce is down 90% from when he bought it. He says they've only had 1 year they made a profit. It was going to go bankrupt without him. Now he's trying to save it. Next, Queen Camilla has said she's furious with Harry because, you know, in Spare, that book that he wrote, he really eviscerates her, accused her of leaking private conversations to the media as she thought to rehabilitate her image after marrying Charles. And we know with Princess Diana dying, she was looked at as the enemy. I think they're over that, but they're not over Harry. I think he's going to sit about eight rows deep. They're not going to let him wear his military uniform, which is wrong because he actually served in the military and saw combat. I just really am going to stop worrying about my own life and focus on the Royals. Please remind me, Eric. All right?
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.